Hello, everybody. This week is Parshas Dvarim, and the Parsha begins with Moshe Rabbeinu giving his final Musar speech to Klal Yisrael. And Rashi on the spot comments, he says, why did Moshe Rabbeinu wait till now, till the last few days of his life to give this speech? Why didn't he give them Musar right away when it happened? And Rashi tells us that Moshe Rabbeinu learned this from Yaakov Avinu. Moshe Rabbeinu learned from Yaakov that Yaakov waited until his final days to give rebuke to his sons, and Moshe Rabbeinu learned to do the same thing, and he waited to his final days to give the Musar. And Rashi says there's a few reasons why a person should wait until their final days before rebuking their children or their students. And one of the reasons, says Rashi, why a person's worth to wait till then is because otherwise you're going to end up in a situation where a person can end up having to be a mechiach, the chayzer mechiach. He'll have to give rebuke, and if the person doesn't listen, you have to give rebuke again, and it turns to nagging, and it doesn't get anywhere. So therefore, you give the rebuke once, and then the person leaves this world, and if the person chooses to listen, great, if not, not. Now, Rashi seems to imply very strongly that a person shouldn't be giving rebuke multiple times. You give the person rebuke, if he listens, good, if not, not. But the Sifsei Chachamim asks the obvious question of Rashi. They say, if you look back in Sefer Vayikra, when the Torah gives us the commandment of giving rebuke to another Jew, it says a double language. It says, Haycheach teichiach, rebuke, you shall rebuke your fellow Jew. And the Gemara Baba Metzia, Daf Lamed Aleph, says, from here we see that it's not always enough to give rebuke once. The Gemara says, you see from here, sometimes you may have to give rebuke once, twice, even up to 100 times. A person may have to give rebuke, and that's how much the mitzvah of giving teichacha obligates you. So how do the two things work together? How do we have a Rashi telling us that rebuke shouldn't be given multiple times, and yet the Gemara says explicitly that it should be given multiple times? The author of Kelmi explains as follows. He says that people make a mistake. They think the Gemara is saying that you give rebuke multiple times because you go to a guy, and you see he's doing something wrong. So you tell him, you got to stop that, it's usser, and the guy chooses not to listen to you. So you come back the next day, tell him again, it's usser, and you nag him, and tell him the same thing over and over again. That's a mistake, says the author of Kelmi. What the Gemara means is as follows. The author of Kelm himself said that sometimes it would take him 2 years to fully give his students rebuke on something. What took 2 years? What it means is that you break down the rebuke. You start off by explaining to the person the concept, how amazing it is, let's say, to daven. Then a couple weeks later, you go and you tell him about how when a person davens to Hashem, he's standing in front of the king, and therefore it's only respectful to behave like this. And then you talk about the concept more another week, couple weeks later. And then slowly but surely you build the concept by the person. You explain to him the meaning of it. And eventually, after enough times, eventually you have him at the place where you can now explain to him what he did wrong, and he's willing to listen to you and accept it. And now he can properly change his ways. Haycheach teichiach, rebuke and rebuke up to 100 times, doesn't mean say the same thing over and over and over again. It means if you have to invest yourself to get this person to do the right thing with 100 different conversations, then that's your mitzvah, that's your obligation. That's what the Gemara means. What Moshe Rabbeinu is doing now on his deathbed, though, is something else. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu spent his whole life doing, setting Klal Yisrael straight, giving them the rebuke in pieces and in steps until he can build them up. Now that Moshe Rabbeinu is leaving, it's his last few days. Now he has to just tell them everything as it is. This is what was a mistake. This one was right. This one was wrong. And now Klal Yisrael is left. They're shown what's right and what's wrong. And now Klal Yisrael has to make the choice to choose what they're doing. And that's why that type of rebuke, an all-out, hold-no-punches type of rebuke, that's where Moshe Rabbeinu has to wait until the end of his days to do. And that's what Yaakov Avinu also waited to give to his children only the Fehi Moshe. When Moshe Rabbeinu lists the different places that they went through, one of them is Di Zahav. And Rashi explains that Di Zahav is really an allusion to the story of the eagle. And Rashi explains that Moshe Rabbeinu is here, as much as he's rebuking Klal Yisrael for the sin of the eagle, he's also kind of standing up on their defense. And he's saying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the reason why they happened, the reason why they sinned, is kind of Hashem's fault a little bit. Because he gave them too much gold. Di Zahav. They're already saying it's enough. Di Zahav. And Moshe Rabbeinu gives a mashal, says the Medrash. He says a mashal to a king who has a son. And he goes and he gives his son fine food and fine wine. He gives him a nice hot bath and a jacuzzi. He gives him fancy oils to anoint himself. And after the son is all fattened up and happy and cheerful, he goes and gives him a big kiss full of money. He gives him a big wallet full of cash, and he parks him right outside the Beis Zaynis, the house of, you know, ill repute. And then the son goes and he sins. And the king's all upset. What were you doing? How'd you go there? What's going on? He says, you set him up. And therefore, says Moshe Rabbeinu, the Kadosh Baruch Hu, you know, you almost kind of, so to speak, set up Klal Yisrael. That's the Rashi. Now, the Sefer Levush Mordechai asks the obvious question. He says, why does Rashi need the whole beginning of the Mashal? He gave him food. He gave him the bath. Very simple. He takes a young boy, you know, a guy who's a teenager, hormones raging, and he put him right in front of the Beis Nus with a pocket full of cash. Of course he's going to sin. Why is it relevant, the fact that he fed him and he bathed him and he gave him wine? Why is that relevant? And he said a very important idea. He says that it's not really true. It doesn't start and end with the fact that the kid has his money right by the Beis Nus. It's an attitude. There's a concept called in Yiddish, Altya, everything yes, I get whatever I want. This kid was spoiled from the beginning. He never had a no in his life. He never had to hold himself back. He had amazing food. He has amazing wine. He has a great, you know, jacuzzi over there. He has his oils. So he develops an attitude of, I don't have to control myself. I don't have to do anything. Everything I want, I get. And therefore, when he gets to his first struggle, where he knows his father doesn't want him to go to the Beis Nus, he has no way to control himself because he never held himself back. It's always been, yes, whatever I want. That's what Rashi is telling us was really what Moshe Rabbeinu's point was that the way a person has to stop himself from sinning, it has to start way back in the beginning. It has to be a concept of, I know that sometimes I tell myself no. My children know that sometimes there's a no. They can't have it. It's an attitude issue. I heard once from Rav Reisman Shlita. He's a big Rav in New York. And he said, it was very interesting that he one time went to the bungalow colony for the summer. And the same people he had in his shul, who would come early in the mornings to learn and were really, really, really good people, when they get to the bungalow colony, they're on vacation in the summers. And then a lot of times the questions and the attitude changed. They would be complaining, oh, why can't they do this? Maybe you can give me a heter like this. And it was the same people. What happened? What changed? And he recognized what happens is that when they go on vacation, they're in a mode of everything has to go. I'm here to have fun. So my whole mindset changes. I'm in happy mode. I'm in let me do whatever I want mode. So everything becomes a restriction. And it's very important that a lot of times when we do go on vacation, we do let ourselves go, to remember that there's still a concept of a Kadosh Baruch who's still in charge, and I don't just do whatever I want. Vacation isn't that everything goes now. I'm here to have as much fun as possible, and any mitzvah or any prohibition is now a restriction on me. And it all starts with an attitude. Is there still an idea by myself that Hashem says what goes, what doesn't go, and Halacha defines for me what I should be doing? Or am I completely in a new mode called everything goes, I'm here to have fun? Further on in the parsha, Moshe Rabbeinu retells how Klal Yisrael is getting too difficult for himself to properly lead. And he says, Eicha esa levadi tarchachem masachem rivchem. How can I carry all your fighting, all your arguments? And then Moshe Rabbeinu introduces the idea of dividing Klal Yisrael into different judges, etc. But the Medrash points out that this language of Eicha is found in three great prophets. And that's, in fact, why we read it with the same tune that we read the Megillas Eicha. Eicha, says the Medrash, is found by Moshe Rabbeinu over here. Eicha esa levadi. Later, it's found by Navi Yeshaya when he says, Eicha nepcha kirya namana. How has Yerushalayim, this great city, turned into such an evil place with all these avarice that are going on? And then finally, the last Navi to use the language of Eicha was Yirmiyahu HaNavi, when he says, Eicha, the lamentations that we say on Tisha B'Av. And the Moshe Feinstein points out that the Medrash isn't saying that, well, you know, look, isn't it convenient how they all use the same language? The Medrash is saying a much deeper point. The Medrash is telling us that what Moshe Rabbeinu was saying Eicha on in his generation, what Yeshaya was saying Eicha on in his point, and what Yirmiyahu ultimately said Eicha on, it was all one trend. It was all one concept, which came out in each generation in its own way. Well, Moshe Rabbeinu laments and says, how could someone deal with people who have such bad midas? That was the core of the issue that came out in the times of Yeshaya in full blast with all the avers that were going on before the destruction of the temple. And that's what came down to the final destruction of the temple, which Yirmiyahu said, and now we have to go and go into Gullus and fix ourselves completely and get rid of these bad midas, because otherwise we're never really fixing the root of the problem. And says Moshe Feinstein, what the Medrash is teaching us is that everything starts with our midas. When a person works on his midas, when a person perfects himself. All the Averis, obviously, they have no appeal to him. He doesn't need to steal. He doesn't need to do the wrong things because he's a good person inside. And that is where the beginning of the rebuilding has to start, is to fix that original Eicha that Moshe Rabbeinu saw and to work on our Midas, and then hopefully we'll be Zeicha to see the proper rebuilding. Afterwards, Moshe Rabbeinu tells Klal Yisrael to go and appoint for themselves judges. Havu lechem anoshim. I saw an interesting idea from Emes Yaakov, from Yaakov Menetsky. He says that if you look in Tanakh, the word ish, the plural of the word ish, is only used as ishim once in Tanakh, somewhere in Iyev, I believe. And everywhere else, it's always like we find here, it's anoshim. He says, why is that? Why do we switch seemingly logically, ish should be ishim, like par, which means a cow, is parim, or parois, depends. Right? It's always straightforward. Why here does the whole entire word switch to become anoshim? And he says like this. He says that the difference is that a group of people together is not just a group of individuals. When a group of people get together to do something, they become much more powerful than than the sum of their parts. They become something new. So ish, when he joins with another ish and they get together, they create anoshim. They create a whole new concept. In Iyav over there, when it talks about the idea of Ishim, that's because over there, those individuals weren't joining together to form a new group. They were just a bunch of individuals together. And that's why they're called Ishim, not Anoshim. It's just a powerful idea for us to remember that when one person gets together with another person to do something great, it's not just two people, it's a whole new thing. It's Anoshim doing something, and they could do much more. Later in the parsha, Moshe Rabbeinu is commanded by Kadosh Baruch Hu that when the Jewish people get close to the nations of Ammon and Moab, they can't fight with them. Their land is theirs. They got an inheritance from Lot. But Rashi points out that there's a difference in the language. When it comes to the nation of Ammon, Hashem says, don't touch them, don't bother them, just hands off completely. When it comes to the nation of Moab, Hashem says, just don't have an all-out war with them. Everything less than that, that's okay. Rashi says, what's the difference? Why does Ammon get the special treatment which Moab doesn't get? So Rashi explains, because we have to recognize, we have to know some history. Where do Ammon and Moab come from? And Rashi tells us that we know that back after Lot escaped from Sodom with his two daughters, we know the whole story, how Lot's daughters gave him wine to drink, and they both became pregnant from him. And that's where Ammon and Moab come from. Now there's a difference, though, between the names Ammon and Moab, because the older daughter, the mother of Moab, she called her son Moab to tell everyone that he's Me'av, he's from her father. The younger daughter, the mother of Ammon, she was a little bit more subtle, a little bit more embarrassed of what she had done. And therefore, she kind of hid it in the name and said, Ammon is from my nation. Says Rashi, the reason why the children of Ammon get special protection and the children of Moab don't is because of the merit of their great-great-great-great-grandmother all those hundreds of years ago, who had a little bit more tznius, a little bit more shame of what she did wrong. And she named her child Ammon instead of saying explicitly that he came from Moab, from her father. And the Mefarshim tells us that this is something we have to always keep in mind. We know that when a person goes to Shemayim, whatever he said, any words he used, will be repeated to him. And the Gemara tells us it comes from a pasuk in Amos, Lahagid la'odam ma'sichay. They're going to tell us over ma'sichay, what it is that we said. And the Nefesh HaChaim asks a question. He says, why does a pasuk use a language of ma'sichay, what it is that we said? Just say, to tell us over, lahagid sichay, to tell us what we said. And he says that the pasuk's teaching is something much more important. You see, there's what we say, and then there's the effects that what we say have. And sometimes the effects of what we say can be very, very, very long-reaching, and we don't even always know. We can't even fathom how far what we said affected. For example, in this case, to think that the mother of Moab would ever dream that what she was kind of, so to speak, lacking in her tznius and in her busha, in her modesty and in her shame, would have ramifications hundreds and hundreds of years later for thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people. All her descendants would suffer because of her lack of tznius. And that the mother of Ammon, that all her children would be given granted extra protection because of her, so to speak, dash more of tznius. No one ever thought of that, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu does. And that's what the Navi is telling us, lahagel odam ma sichay, not just the actual words you said, but ma, what happened from that? What was the ramifications of that? How far reaching it is. And then a person finds out, wow, I did that? I caused all that? That's either amazing or oh no. And that's something we have to keep in mind whenever we use our voice, whenever we say something, to realize that there's a lot of ramifications. So let's think twice to use our voice and to use our speech for something positive, because the ramifications can be amazing. You give a guy a nice compliment. You say something good to a person. It puts him in a good mood. He's a better father. He's a better mother. They're a better spouse. And the whole thing changes. You have no idea what kind of things cycle out of that. And that is what we're learning from this parasha of lahakid la'odem ma'asichay, to tell a person how powerful and all the ramifications of speech have. We should all be zeiche to have a wonderful Shabbos and always be zeiche to make positive and good ramifications amongst everyone around us.